Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And, there's a lot of hyperbole talking about our financial conditions, the pending financial doom. Folks, I'm telling you, the rumors are churning, and there's plenty of economists that are basically saying America is at a turning point where we're this next financial. So there's I'll call them oracles because they're definitely not prophets, but they're financial smart people that are looking, you know, in between, you know, the debris and the tea leaves, and looking at minutiae between nuances of economies, markets, debts, and these types of things. And the whole point of what I'm trying to tell you is that everything they are looking at, they believe it is all legitimate. The states, at any point in time, can stand up and say, hold on here. You know, it has come to our attention that we've been duped by you. You've lied to us. You've told us you can do anything, and everything that you're doing is legitimate. And yet here in these founding documents, it clearly says you do not have the authority to do these things. Ergo, you didn't have the authority to create this debt. Ergo, we're not responsible for it. And ergo, those people that were providing you the money should have done the due diligence, because they would have found the same thing out that we just found out. That this is all a concocted plan that you can assume more and more debt, waste it, so that the world can basically end up controlling America. Sorry, it's not going to play out that way. And as a matter of fact, anybody and everybody that's alive, we're going to start, you know, rounding you up, and we're going to start deporting you out to the highest bidder of who wants to, you know, keel haul you or whatever they want to do. And you know what keel haul means. Welcome back, Sean, by the way.
Yes, sir.
And you know what keel haul means, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. It's not fun. And the bigger the ship, I remember I was on an amphibious carrier, a flat top, that carries helicopters, the Tarawa. And it's a big ship. And I was going, man, I sure hope I don't go keel hauled with this one. Because I definitely could not hold my breath that long. And so, anyway, it was a form of punishment at sea. That being said, folks, I want you to understand that if we get our government back and actually start demanding full compliance of the Constitution, that means we're going to dispatch that debt. That means that we're going to be in a position to basically demand our wealth back. There are going to be a lot of things on the table, and I'm not here to tell you what to do, other than we've got to get our country back, because at least you can start making the decisions that could, you know, decimate us by trying to send us into a world war when maybe we're not ready. I don't know, but bottom line is all of these things, and there's people that are looking at Trump, you know, saying that these are the foolish things he can do and blah, 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 blah. So today's not really going to be a content day. When we started going through the Constitutional Convention, leading into it, we covered the combined state acts, the document that's up on the academic, you know, academic source documents, the ASD page. It's the proverbial horse's mouth on Reclaiming the Republic. We read through these things. That's where all of the documents are, and we ask you. And so this next time I do a posting, I will put James Madison's notes, all of the updates to it, on the website, so that now you can go back and listen to what we've been reading and I've been marking up as we've gone through, so that you can actually go through and read yourself and see for yourself if you need that. I think that most people that have been going through this enough don't necessarily need it. I will tell you that I've got a lot of people that are getting excited about standing up county resistance and starting to move and creating constitutional compliance committees and so forth. Folks, do not dally. The time is now. And so many of these folks are realizing that they're going to be standing in front of people leading, and they just don't know what they need to know. And so I told them, and I've been telling people, go back to when we last read through the Constitution. That was back in September 17th when Sean and I picked up the Constitution and read it to its in, through its entirety. And I believe that was every show, correct, Sean? I mean, Monday through Friday, we did a reading of the Constitution until we were done with it. And yes, so I think that took us probably, let me say, 30 days. 30-some days. Let's just say 30-some days. So that means 30-some hours, less than a week's labor that you would be paid. You could go through and be smart on the Constitution, line by line, clause by clause, and the background behind all of these things. I mean, for the most part, when we go through content, I try not to dive into details unless it merits it. I mean, I'm not a person that likes to naturally go off and, you know, just dilly-dally, but a lot of times there are ancillary pieces of information, things that, you know, the framers talked about on the ratification basis that we want to expound upon. And then really what ends up happening is we start bringing context to today's life, what's going on, and how what we're now reading and saying, hey, hold on here. You know, how does this jive with this or that? And that usually becomes the tangled web that, you know, that pulls me out, and we tend to spend a little more time on it. The point is that you can go through all of those things. It's all relevant. And I promise you, you're going to learn the Constitution as if you're learning it from the framers. And I'm not claiming to be a framer. I'm claiming that I've read the framers so many times, I can tell you how they explained each of those lines. You go to Hillsdale College, and they're going to give you the politically correct how the federal government has now interpreted, because they embrace this concept of the living Constitution. They may not come right out and say that, but they don't challenge the federal government in all of its challenges. Now, I don't know if that's because of money or because I think Hillsdale College, I want to think that they might be independent, but they lack the moral fortitude of actually doing the right thing. And so, and I just say that because if they're not basing the education and the Constitution on the ratification debates, as Madison basically told his friends, his associates, and his colleagues in government throughout his entire career, read the ratification debates. You want to understand the Constitution, read the ratification debates, because that's how the states understood the Constitution, and that's the only thing that matters. Therefore, teaching you something out of the Federalist Papers, teaching you anything else, it's a red herring. It has no context. So anyway, the point is that you're going to need this education. Well, we've been providing it for you every year. And we give it to you a little bit, a little bit, a little bit. And anybody that just kind of pops in and listens, you know, maybe, you know, one day a week or something like that, you probably have picked up, you know, over the course of 3-4 years of listening, more than anybody else understands the Constitution today. The problem is there's a lot of gaps you need to fill. If you're going to get involved, you really do need to have a good understanding of the Constitution. And in tandem with that, we've created for free a color-coded Constitution that basically lays out, one color-coded lays out the violations, how the Constitution is being directly violated, and the other one lays out specifically what each clause is enumerating. Is it a role? Is it a responsibility? Is it a restriction? Is it a criminal law, criminal justice type of thing? So that you understand what it is you are reading, because the question always has to come in mind. Is this granting, is this line granting Congress the power to be able to change any word in this line? Because if it's not one of those lines that they can touch and change, then they can't redefine it. They can't do anything. They have to live by it as a gold standard. And so the color-coded enumeration, the color-coded constitution of the enumerations in the Constitution help you understand exactly that, because we have two different, as you look at the top, we explain the two layers of the color coding. With that, it's all about compliance of the Constitution. And so I probably, passed over quite a lot of things like our pending doom. What's more important, folks, is that we actually start having champions in the public forum starting to demand that we get our government to stop spending money on things they have no authority to spend money on. That means that, we're going to have to, pick ourselves up by our bootstraps, get things done. We're going to have to feed ourselves whatever it's going to take. As a matter of fact, just keep in mind that in a Republican form of government, your representatives have the ability to basically provide you the redress, the legal redress you need. We're at a point now where our existing system has been built upon fraud, i.e. the banking, mortgage, all of these types of things that I would see down the road where it would require some of these institutions to go away. The Fed, go away. And that's when the people start demanding these things. And so the states are going to have to figure out, because clearly the federal government has no authority to dictate what the standards of banking are. They can't even have a bank. They have the responsibility of maintaining a currency and managing the value thereof, of maintaining a high value of our currency, not to let it get watered down. As a matter of fact, I don't think we've ever covered it. I've pointed to it in a petition, but if you go into the first Banking Act, I think of 1792, somewhere in there, it basically states by law that the standards of the purity of the precious metal must be maintained at a high level, at the highest level possible. So that's why we got to 99.9. Anyway, let me get back to what we want to focus on here. The reality is that we started the convention, Madison's notes on the convention, at the time the legislation was beginning to ramp up its dog and pony show on the two institutions that are getting money out of your pocket, because I believe these people get paid to go and do this dance for your legislators. And it frustrates me and it upsets me that your legislatures allow themselves to be pulled into these antics. So what I want to do is talk about how the legislatures can actually shut this down. But before we do, what I want to do is I want to actually go in and attack some of the two sides that are presenting false information. Now, I'm going to call one side the conventionites. And a conventionite is a person that wants and is demanding that we call for a convention. And the other side is the anti-conventionites. And these are the people that are saying, no, don't do it. It's the worst thing you can do. And they bring in all hyperbole and they use all the dramatics possible by using the progressive tactics of fear-mongering, those types of things. But it's not like the conventionites aren't equally doing the same thing. And so they're both equally dubious, and they've convinced everybody that our path forward is only two ways. Either we commit to this convention or we commit to something else. And that something else is not tenable. because the anti-conventionites are telling us that we just need to nullify, state nullification. Just stop allowing those things to happen. In other words, ignore the problem. Because state nullification does not stop the problem or fix the problem. It just says, we're not going to enforce that, we're not going to abide by that. And that right there creates chaos. We've kind of covered this before. But what we want to do right now is cover this again in context to what we have read. And since I didn't read it, Sean read it, I think it's only apropos, and if we'll have Tammy in here next with Sean, and we'll talk a little bit about what we read. And so the point is we need to review really quick without reading it in its entirety. We need to read through the enabling acts, or I should say the state authorizing of the election of delegates for the convention and empowering them. They're kind of more of an empowering act where they are empowered to go and represent the state on matters of fixing the Articles of Confederation. So with Sean, Sean, we've kind of read through this, and I think we did a decent job in identifying the two states. Do you remember what those two states are that claimed to have reservations on the in the convention? In other words, there were two states that expressed to their delegates very specific actions not to take. Do you remember what those states were?
Right off the top of my head, I'm thinking New York and Rogue Island.
Okay. Now,
but I'm not. Don't quote me on that.
Yeah, that's okay. If you've got the document up, folks, the document we're using is the Combined State Acts authorizing the election of delegates for the 1787 Constitution Convention. And so these acts were basically created by the act of the state legislature deciding who they were going to send, how they were going to send, what they were going to do. And there were two states, and technically the two states were, Delaware was the first one. And this is what Delaware wanted to make sure. They said, you know, do anything you need. As a matter of fact, this is the blank check that they wrote, that these three men are hereby constituted and appointed deputies from this state with powers to meet such deputies as may be appointed and authorized by the other states to assemble in the said convention at the city aforesaid, and to join with them in devising, deliberating, and discussing such alterations as further provisions may be necessary to render the federal constitution adequate to the exigencies of the union. Now, devising means what?
Constructing.
Formulating, right? It's basically developing. Creating. There you go. So devising means actually putting pen to paper and submitting a recommendation. Devising something that can deal with, you know, the federal constitution and make it adequate to deal with the exigencies of the union at the time. The whole point was they were looking for fixing and saving the union, the exigencies of the union, not the exigencies of the Articles of Confederation. They were to deal with and devise, deliberate, and discuss alterations, such alterations and further provisions. So in other words, go do what you think is necessary. And then the caveat came in, this is strictly Delaware, that such alterations or further provisions or any of them do not extend to that part of the fifth article of the Confederation of the said states, finally ratified on the first day of March in the year 1781. And now that's when they ratified it, I think. No, I think that's the year that... was it 81? I think it was 83 when they finally ratified. Anyway, which declares that, quote, in determining questions in the United States in Congress assembled, each state shall have one vote. So in other words, Delaware wanted to make sure that all states had equal footing. And when they say each state shall have one vote, does that mean that the popular vote, you know, the majority of the people of the state get that, is the source of that one vote? Is that what we're deriving here?
No. I would say the state as a whole gets one vote.
Right, which means specifically it's a body of men that we call the state legislature. In other words, the legislature gets that one vote, that one voice. It is the legislature that understands the businesses of the state, and they're the ones that have that equal footing, or they're the ones that wanted to maintain their control to ensure that bigger states didn't get more representation, more power, more political or voting power over them, that all states would maintain equal voting power in the union. That's what that meant. Now, you've read through the Constitution. How did what they did in the Constitution not meet that one hard caveat?
Mm.
Because the anti-conventionites are saying this was a runaway convention. Do me a favor, while I babble here, look up Google the definition, the specific wording for runaway, because that's a pretty harsh word. In my mind, what they're saying is these men that went to this convention completely abandoned their morals and their responsibility. A runaway is somebody that completely abandons what they're supposed to do. And so what does, you know, the magical oracle Google and AI tell you?
Hypothetical scenario where an Article 5 convention proposes amendment beyond the scope of what the states requested or intended.
Okay. I'm just looking for the word runaway. I'm not looking for the context of a convention and its usage. When you use a word runaway, that means something very, the word runaway is very specific.
Yeah, it's like when you get a runaway on a diesel engine.
Right, it just it's out of control.
Regardless.
It's out of control. You can't control it anymore.
Right,
okay.
Exactly.
All right, so when we look up the
word. Person or animal that is runaway, something that has escaped control or proper confinement.
There we go. Okay, so do you believe, because how many times, especially going into July, there were several times, you may not remember how many, but there were, do you not remember several times where we stopped and read a little bit where somebody was saying, hey, I think we may be losing, you know, what we should be doing and exceeding our commission in doing this thing or this thing. And actually, it was Delaware that was the one that brought it up to say, look, we're here to make sure that we're not coming home with a piece of crap that says you don't get one full, you don't have equal footing in this union anymore because you're a small state, you don't have the population, and you're inconsequential. Because that was what, right here, what they said, we will not allow this to happen. Don't come with us, don't give us a piece of paper that doesn't do that. And actually, the piece of paper that they got when they read the Constitution, I'm sure that they quickly pointed out, hey, go read Article 5 and read that last sentence that provided that no amendment be made, that the state legislature cannot lose its equal, without its consent, cannot lose its equal suffrage in the Senate. Boom. In other words, all states have equal suffrage in the Senate, and it's galvanized right there that they will always maintain that. No amendment can take that away from them. I think that's a pretty good security in maintaining this hard requirement. Don't you think that?
I agree, sir.
Awesome. So with that, we're going into a break. And so we will dive back into this when we come back, because I may be, you know, kind of laboring this point, but one of the things that we have to do is we actually have to use the specific source documents and live by those things, not by hyperbole and by opinion. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so this kind of opens up the door, because what I'm trying to do is I want to go through what we read and what the requirement was to confirm that by reading these requirements that are on paper, and how these men constantly either reeled themselves or did a check on themselves. Hey, look here. You know, we have this hard requirement that we can't come back with a piece of paper that does not give us our equal footing and or maintain our state sovereignty one-to-one. So when we look at this concept of a republican form of government, I'm going to dive a little bit outside the box, because it comes up in the Massachusetts caveat. Because remember I said that there were two states, it was Delaware and Massachusetts. And in Massachusetts, they talk about the importance that this government maintain the Republican spirit, a Republican form of government. This is what the caveat in Massachusetts that came from the Senate, which moved forward and said, thou shalt go and do good things, except do not cross these lines. And it says, and it is further resolved that the said delegates on the part of this Commonwealth be there, they are hereby instructed not to accede, not to agree to any alterations or additions that may be proposed to be in the present Articles of Confederation, which may appear to them not to consist with the true Republican spirit and genius of the said Confederation. Are you reading this with me? This is on, this would be on page 4 at the very bottom.
I'm not with you, sir.
Oh, okay. I just want to make sure you're reading this with me. Because this is word for word, folks, that they wanted to make sure that there was no departing from the Republican spirit and genius of the said Confederation. Now, one of the things that came out, and we heard this constantly through the convention, tell me if I'm wrong, just pipe in, that they kept on talking about republicanism and how they wanted to, and you know, increase republicanism. The only place that they didn't increase republicanism was in the courts. In other words, the courts were going to be appointed by the president, and there was going to be no control over where these justices would be coming from. In other words, they would just represent supposedly the law, because they were in this pipe dream thinking that, you know, the, all justices would be pure and noble and men of integrity, and that actually proved otherwise very quickly. But the fact is that when we look at the selection of the president, it's done in a Republican form, not a Democratic form, by using and creating an electoral college, and then they choose for themselves who is to be president, and they choose for themselves who is to be vice president. That is based on the 12th Amendment. This is going through the Constitution. And, you know, because the 12th Amendment changed the Electoral College because there was a problem with the deficiency. And so that's why they made sure that the electors actually broke away who they were voting for vice president and who they were voting for president, instead of just placing two names on a ballot. Because then it was, you know, whoever had the highest names. So they wanted to make sure they were differentiating who the Electoral College thought who would be best for vice president as well as who would be best for president. You can't get much more Republican than that. Because today, we actually have the good old boy system where the, you know, the nominee for the president gets to choose his vice president, contrary and unconstitutionally, contrary to the Constitution, that the Electoral College will decide who those are, not the party, and not the nominations in that process. So anyway, moving on, it says, and particularly that they by no means interfere with the fifth of the said articles, which provides, quote, for the annual election of delegates in Congress with a power reserved to each state to recall its delegates or any of them within the year to send others in their stead for the remainder of the year, and which also provides that no person shall be capable of being a delegate for more than 3 years in any term of six, or being a delegate shall be capable of holding any office under the United States for which he and or other for his benefit receives any salary, fees, or emolument of any kind. Now, I'm going to tell you, but I'm going to let you tell me, did they satisfy that one specific requirement?
Yes, they did.
How'd they do that?
By having the legislatures choose the senators.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the other part? It's almost verbatim what's in the Constitution about not having any other office.
Okay, so there are those types of things. They address those. But is there a mechanism in the Constitution for recall of the senators and representatives?
Well, I don't... I think the 14th Amendment,
yes.
Once it was established.
Yeah. You're right. That got fixed.
But what about, what is it, Article 6?
Uh-huh.
The third clause, I believe.
Yeah, the supremacy clause.
Bound by oath.
Yeah, they're bound by oath, correct. So the recall of the senators was a little bit easier for the state legislature, but a recall for a representative was pretty difficult. More importantly, this, when you look at this requirement proposes, or at least makes the supposition that they would have instant knowledge of what was going on so they could immediately find out and recall. Now, yeah, if it's happening in Faneuil Hall, right there in Boston, where everybody can watch and hear, and the word spreads like wildfire within a day that person violated their oath and get them out of there. But now you're talking about a government that's meeting way down in the Potomac. You know, there's no telegraph that's taking you up there. How do you get the word of what just happened? And the details and the facts on, you know, is this just somebody using hyperbole? Or, you know, what are the facts before you can really chase somebody down to say, we got to recall this person? Obtaining the facts is pretty easy when you're co-located and you're watching the event and you've got a bunch of eyewitnesses. But when you only have one person that's telling you, hey, this guy did this, we got to recall him. That could be just a vendetta.
What about, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, what about the honor of the other men in the chamber? Shouldn't the onus be on them to say you're violating your oath and not say, oh, well, that's up to his constituents to deal with that?
So they did deal with that by creating the ethics and the code to be basically policed by each house. In other words, the House of Representatives is to maintain the code of whether somebody gets expelled or not, and the same thing with the Senate. But that didn't prove to actually work. That's why Section 3 of the 14th Amendment came along. But So there's a couple of things that this was so specific and so petty. And this actually, when we read through the ratification page, you're going to see, wow, this actually comes up big time. And they have more contention in Massachusetts over the term of office and term limits and these types of things than any other state, bar none. I mean, it's like, you know, when you look at Massachusetts, and when you look at each of the states, you can really get the spirit of the culture as they question certain things, you know, where their focus is. And when you get with Massachusetts, you can see that the majority of the men there, they have the title reverend. And they're very focused on righteousness, and they're very focused on, you know, the diligence of service and so forth. So they believe that term limits actually forces compliance. But in this particular caveat, it was too difficult to really provide and make it so that all the other states, because as Massachusetts during the convention, they actually brought some of these things up. They argued over the terms, and they didn't win. They don't like the fact that the senator is elected for 6 years. They wanted to make sure that they could only be elected for a couple of years at the most, and then be able to recall them, and that they could only serve a couple of times. I mean, they didn't trust their representatives much, or they didn't give them a chance, you know, to actually do not good things, but to you know, to provide good service. Anyway, so in a way, when Massachusetts came back in the Constitutional Convention, they tried to bring these things up and said, look, these things we told you not to do. And they, hey, you know, there were 12 or 11 other states there, and they didn't see the necessity of these things being such sacred ground to not, you know, trample over, to disregard. You know, the more important things was, you know, does the president have all power? That type of stuff. So anyway, and we'll get into the ratification debates. But this being the second caveat and the only other caveat that they had, there was this other underlying term that I started off with, which was this Republican spirit, right? And so when you look at Massachusetts, the Republican spirit came up then. It also basically, they referenced the Republic in North Carolina, the devising of that, and South Carolina, or no, actually New Hampshire was the same. And when we look at Connecticut, in their empowerment, this is what they said, that these delegates shall actually attend the said convention is and are hereby authorized and empowered to represent the state therein, to confer with, and this is pretty common with all of the states, they said the same language, that with such delegates appointed by the several states for the purposes mentioned in the said act of Congress, that may present and duly empowered to act in said convention and to discuss upon the alterations, provisions agreeable to the general principles of Republican government, as they shall think proper to render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of government and to the preservation of the Union. Now, one of the things that came up at the very end was Governor Randolph. And I think we read this yesterday or the day before, where Governor Randolph was proposing that, you know, they don't ratify this, that all the states basically make their amendments, they make their cuts on the Constitution, and that they go into another convention. Remember that?
Yes, sir.
And the point is, and I think this is, he was shot down quickly, because all you're doing is you're failing to commit. You're committing to not to commit. It's almost like the guy that, you know, wants to continue dating and what have you, but not committing to marriage. He's just committed to not committing. Doesn't want to go anywhere, doesn't want to look. And as a matter of fact, I heard, you know, in a comedy where a guy had that attitude because he, you know, what if somebody else better comes along? You know, and in other words, kind of leaving their options open. And at this point in time, I can easily say that that would have been folly, because getting the same delegates back and having gone through the same debates and so forth and the arguments and all of that, getting a whole new group of people, how successful would a second convention be with different people?
It'd probably been less successful than the first.
Correct. Are you familiar with, I think it is Chile. I think it's Chile. Maybe it's Argentina. There's a South American country that has been in a open convention in rewriting its constitution, and how long it has been struggling to obtain a constitution. Because it's open to everybody. And the parameters of agreeing to move forward has been stifled because everybody, the bar is way too difficult to reach. In other words, they cannot all come to an agreement. They've been incapable of actually getting the smart people in the room to basically deal with and leave it. This is what happens when you have every cook in the kitchen available, you know, from all the households going into a convention. You've got every kitchen's cook in there, and they all, oh, no, you got to add a little spice. Using the metaphor of how they prefer to have things, it becomes so subjective, it's impossible to come out with a final product. You have to empower people to make those decisions. And you have to empower people to make the best decisions. And so the people that you want to empower are should be your best and brightest, that they can actually support their arguments, not just become, you know, a good salesman in selling people on some whimsical idea. And so when we look at this concept of trying to go into a convention and fixing the Constitution by trying to amend it, then we've opened up a Pandora's box, because when we look at the Constitutional Convention today, what's the problem with the Constitution first and foremost? What's the problem?
They're not following it.
They're not, so in other words, they're not abiding by the Constitution. So in other words, the answer is there's nothing wrong with the Constitution. If the question is, what needs to be fixed in the Constitution? What in the Constitution is causing the problem?
I would say a method of accountability, an immediate and clearly defined process for dealing with the representatives who violate their oath and try to usurp the Constitution.
Okay, so we now have a fix to that.
Including the judicial branch.
We now have a fix to that. With Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, that does fix that. When we look at the framers, and we'll get this, I think, in the ratification debates, but you have to extrapolate, what would the reason be for, what would the, you know, any amendment would have to fit under one of these very minute categories or very specific categories. An amendment would be required to the Constitution if a part of the Constitution is a deficiency or is a problem, it's causing a problem. The Electoral College caused a problem. It made it very hard to select the president in the 1800 election. And it took a long time for them to finally get across the finish line in selecting who would be president and vice president. And they said, we can't do this again. And so they came up with the 12th Amendment that actually changed that to where we no longer have that problem, empowering the Electoral College to make ultimately the decision of who's going to be president and vice president, to kind of separate that. It's the same thing with the 11th Amendment. The 11th Amendment became a fix to the deficiency of giving the Supreme Court or the federal court system extra jurisdiction to get involved in cases between citizens of another state and a state, and are foreigners and a state. In other words, they literally took away and gutted out half of the jurisdiction in that paragraph of jurisdiction in Article 3. So when you have a problem, you say this is not going to cut it because the federal court is getting into our knickers and they're making decisions that we don't feel fits our justice. The whole point of the federal court was to adapt to serve justice for the state, not to become the advocate for the citizen or the individual. They didn't care about the citizens because there was nowhere in the Constitution that where they had the Bill of Rights, the Bill of Rights weren't there. The only thing that they were doing is they were serving the Union through serving the states. They did have the Amity Clause, and the Amity Clause was in Article 3, I think Section 2, where citizens of the several states had the right, as they did in their state, to go to, it's called the Reciprocity Clause as well. You can, you know, if you have the ability to get a driver's license at the age of 12 in the state of Louisiana, and it's 16 in other states and 18 in other states, that 12-year-old has the right to drive with that legitimate driver's license from their state through those states of 16 and 18. Because they actually have a legitimate license, and that license will be recognized by all other states. Does that make sense? So, I mean, they get into some of those things, but the whole point was not to create, and they deliberately tried to stay away from a Bill of Rights. And for whatever reason, after the ratification of the Constitution, Madison made it a mission of his to deliver a Bill of Rights. It wasn't that the Bill of Rights was ever a contentious issue in the court system or anything until the Civil War. So in my, this is GR's feed on this. At the time, these men, these good, righteous men, understood liberty, and they understood these things like ex post facto law, things that we just don't understand. They probably started losing the understanding of the concept of a standing army and, you know, what that meant, because it all started going sideways shortly after, you know, we had this government. And they stopped, you know, learning about the Constitution. Well, that's all right. We got a good Constitution. It's working great. Because there was no real federal encroachments on the rights of the people. They were working and they were off doing things, helping the states and, you know, building the military and fighting off the engines. And, I'm just not to be disparaging. The point is that they didn't have many cases. I mean, I can't think of any landmark case that was a civil rights case until after the Civil War. So why the Bill of Rights so early and by Madison? I believe he was moved by the divine hand of providence to create probably the best shot of encapsulating the inalienable rights of the people by basically giving us the Ninth Amendment, which is the catch-all, and then the Tenth Amendment asserting that, you know, no state, or I should say the federal government, think power is not delegated, can't be done by them. It's reserved to the states and the people. When you look at what he included in those 12 amendments, it was awesome. But they never really took a position in protecting people until the 14th Amendment. So in other words, if you look in the 1860s, do you think that the Congress, the radical Republicans, would have been able to get the Constitution amended by the states by addressing those things at that point in time if they weren't already in the federal Constitution?
That would have been tough.
It would have. It absolutely would have. Because why are you bringing up the right to bear arms? Because many of the states would say, well, we kind of don't want these guys to have arms. These men understood why these things were important, going through the Constitution and so forth. And it basically made Madison's challenge of creating the Bill of Rights a little, a kind of a tall order. But bottom line, he successfully did it. And because they had the Bill of Rights, Section 4, or I should say, Section 1 of the 14th Amendment helped clear the way to ensure that states could not step upon the inalienable rights of citizens. By making that one clause, no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges or immunities, or inalienable rights, by any state. So no state could enforce or create a law or enforce a law that would violate those rights. Basically, it just dovetailed, seamlessly integrated the Constitution and the Bill of Rights into applying this protection upon the states. It didn't take away states' rights. It just said, you can't be bad actors with your own people. You can't oppress people anymore for whatever reason. If they're a U.S. citizen, you can't oppress them. So as we look at the convention, though, now that we've kind of gone through this commission, is there any evidence here that the convention in any way violated the Constitution? Or I should say, their commission. What they did in creating this Constitution and the Constitutional Convention, were they a runaway convention, as the anti-conventionites have stated?
I would say no.
Is there any evidence that proves that they literally said, hey, we don't care, we're going to do this? Not at all.
No, there's evidence to the contrary.
Absolutely. In other words, they were very cognizant. They kept on bringing it up and going, hey, look, you know, we understand what we need to be providing, but we don't have time to throw some ideas on the wall and go back to the states and then try to have another convention. The intent was to try to fix it and fix it in this one try, knowing that if they didn't do it now, there was no chance that they'd ever get it done, because there were the state cabals were those guys that were committed to not to commit, because they already had a good thing. And had that happened, had what Randolph suggested, America would have been confronted with France by not being able to pay its debt under the rule of Napoleon Bonaparte. And I don't think our history would be anything like it was, like it is today, had that happened. My point is that the divine hand of providence saw all of the things that were happening and gave these men everything they needed to come to an agreement in providing the exemplar form of government for the world, that all nations could easily become a state in this union, in this constitutional republic. But they would have to change their language. They'd have to change their laws. They would have to change their paradigms. I mean, you couldn't be a theocracy anymore. And I don't want to say you had to be Christian, but your faith had to embrace individual liberty and individual sovereignty for all people, all citizens, and so forth. So when we come back, what I then want to do is I want to talk about the two arguments, because the arguments of the path forward of how to deal with, because Sean hit it right there on the nail on the head. He hit it right there by saying that the problem isn't the Constitution, it's the government. They're violating it. So I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.